You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. You know, you hear speeches like the one John McCain just made, and you ask yourself, why don't we hear that more? Why don't we hear that more? I remember seeing Bob Dole and Bill Clinton on a panel after neither one of them was holding elected office anymore, and they were talking about farm policy in the United States, ag policy in the United States, and they were both brilliant. They had this incredible back and forth. I thought, where was that when they were elected? And I will tell you this, the reason that it doesn't happen is because this political party thing we have going on. So, yeah, not good. Anyway, his speech, was jaw-dropping. It was statesmanlike, and we don't see a lot of that behavior anymore out of Washington, D.C., so I thought you should hear it again. Joining me from the vicinity of Boise, Idaho, is a Lance Corporal-turned-filmmaker. And that is Ken Rogers. So, Ken, first of all, good morning. How are you?
I'm great, sir. How are you?
Mac is fine. I'm all right. I got actually, I'm excited today. I stumbled into this issue courtesy of a company commander who was at Quezon. I had a conversation with him, and he asked me if I knew anything about My Lai, and I said, well, generally, yeah, but not in detail. And then after I got off the phone, I thought, how the hell do I not know something? Do I not know more about that? And then what really got me interested was one of the first things I read, which completely contradicted what I thought, was they had only been in Vietnam for 7 weeks. In my mind's eye, I have them in Vietnam for almost a year. They've gone through all this craziness that combat is, and they're pissed, and they exact their retribution among a village that had been a thorn in their side for a prolonged period of time, a village in which they had lost soldiers, and none of that was the case. They'd never been there. Blah 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 blah. They had in 7 weeks, in almost 2 months, they'd had three soldiers killed and 30-plus wounded. So, and they'd never been in a serious firefight. So then I started watching interviews. So what I want to do was, the reason your name came up in my head was Vietnam. You know, was it so different from other conflicts we participated in, or was it different for other reasons? Yesterday, Jarvis Lynch was on, Major General, United States Marine Corps, retired, Vietnam guy, and he said, look, Mac, leadership is leadership. You know, and Vietnam might have been new in 63, 64, but 68, 69, we've been fighting that thing for 5 years. We knew we were going into parts insurgency, parts conventional ops. We had jungle training before we went. We had, you know, people built Asianvilles and things like that that we practiced in. And so, we had a clue about what we were getting into. Now, bad leaders, you know, they do bad things. And I think it's interesting also from the light of the Commandant of the Marine Corps has this kind of keep your honor clean campaign going, and it deals with some of the fallout from Paris Island, from the fallout of Marines United, and I dare say it also the fallout from urinating on corpses in Afghanistan, killing people, dragging them out of their house and killing them in Iraq. And so, but my approach to that is very different. I look at it in terms of post-combat related mental health. And as I watched the guys from My Lai be interviewed and how drastically they changed from they first get interviewed in 1970 when the story gets made public. When you see interviews with them 20 years later, and they've had to live with this for all that time. They're drastically different human beings. What they say is drastically different. And so so when I look at this, it's like, you know, there's a reason that you need to do the right thing. There's a reason why leaders need to intervene. And that is because, again, as Maximus says in Gladiator, what you do in life echoes in eternity. And you live with it. And so in the midst of that, I was looking for, who could I have on that could speak to that? And I thought, Rogers, man, he was a Lance Corporal at Quezon. What was your rank at Quezon?
Lance Corporal.
Lance Corporal. How old were you?
Well, I was 21.
So you were actually in that group, you were the old guy.
I was, I think, probably, other than the platoon commander and the platoon sergeant, I was probably the oldest guy.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I mean, we're incredibly different force today. So after that long preamble that I just went through, give me some general thoughts on what I said, and start wherever the hell you want to.
Well, I think the leadership is certainly a critical issue, and you know, especially if you figure that a lot of these guys that are snuffies in your unit, you know, are 7, 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old kids, which is, I'm sure, was the case of what happened to me. They can get a little confused about what they're supposed to be doing, I suspect. So you need somebody in there to keep them from right and wrong. And if your leader isn't, you know, I think, let me just make a statement here. I think a lot of what governs some of this stuff is a sense of amorality, what I call amorality, which is you don't have a clear issue of what's right and wrong in a situation.
Right.
So if your leader isn't in there and to point out to, you know, this is not what you do in this given situation, then I think this kind of stuff happens because these young guys aren't really sure in the situation what they're supposed to do. I remember when I first got to Vietnam, we were stationed down southwest of Da Nang at a place called Hill 55, and Bravo Company was off down south of that a ways in a burned out ville. It had probably been some French plantation. And we went out on a patrol, maybe the first patrol I ever went out on, and we went out on a river and it was wide, big wide river. I don't know the name of it. I don't know exactly where it was, because I was still trying to figure out who the hell I was and what I was supposed to be doing. But some, you know, the men and me, there was a squad, opened fire on a bunch of kids washing water buffaloes on the other side of the river. And they didn't hit anybody, I don't think, and the kids took off and the water buffaloes took off, and I was standing there like a dumb shit. And the squad leader comes up to me and asks me why I wasn't shooting, and I really didn't have an answer for him. And he said, let me tell you something. Little gooks grow up to be big gooks. And so it was okay to kill kids. And so I didn't shoot at him. If I had been more squared away and known what I was doing, maybe I would have. I don't know the answer to that. But I guess my point is that was a case of this leadership issue. You know, here was our boss telling us it was okay to shoot a kid, so let's get online and let's fire away. And I think that happened a lot in Vietnam. And I don't think it was just sergeants and corporals. I remember early in my tour, a bunch of guys came from 326. A bunch of seasoned Marines, good Marines, who I believe had been on the battalion landing team that came there when they first came from Pendleton in 66. And we got five or six of these guys in our platoon, and the other platoons all got some of these guys, and I couldn't figure out why they were there, what had happened. So I asked one of them one night, actually there were two of them, what had happened, and they told me that they had been in the Oshawa Valley, their battalion, and they had taken a lot of casualties, and so they just got online and they went down through these villes and they killed everything. They killed the dogs, the cats, the pigs, the people, burned them out. And so the Marine Corps just took all those guys and disseminated them over a bunch of units. I don't know if that really happened, but I had no reason to doubt these guys. They were good Marines. They were good men. A lot of them didn't survive their service over there. So I think it was more common than we think. You know, back in the Philippine War, which in some ways I think was similar to what happened in Vietnam because of the guerrilla business, there was a Marine Corps major named Littleton Waller who took a unit across the southern island of Samar and ran into a lot of problems. And after he was done, he summarily executed 11 Filipino porters for mutiny and theft without a trial. He was subsequently court-martialed and found not guilty, but his commanding officer, who was an Army Brigadier General by the name of, I believe, Jacob Smith, was court-martialed because he had given Major Waller orders to kill everybody over the age of 10 that was a male, which Waller did not do. But it was like, I think this kind of stuff is common in combat in some regards, more common than we want to think. I'm reading General H.R. McMaster's book, Dereliction of Duty.
How depressing is that?
Well, it's just, you know, after what I saw over there and then all this time later to read that, it's like, you know, for Christ's sakes, man, what the hell were we even doing there?
Seriously, it is one of the most depressing books you'll ever read in terms of dysfunction, deception, lying at the cabinet level, in the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It's a depressing read.
It's depressing because I think it was one of the either George Ball or one of the McBundys gamed it out to be exactly what happened. If we don't do this, if we do this, this is likely what's going to happen, and this is what happened. It was like they knew what was going to happen. But anyway, one of the things in there that really got my attention in terms of thinking about this was in early 1965. Lyndon B. Johnson, who was the president of the United States at the time, basically told the chiefs of staff that he wanted to have a meeting once a week to see how many of those Viet Cong we had killed. So to me, I'm thinking about, I wonder if that's where all this business about body count and the importance of showing up with numbers came about. And I wondered how much that had to play in Vietnam and in My Lai. We need some bodies. We need, you know, we need, because my particular rank, if I'm Lieutenant Cowley's commanding officer or the commanding officer over the battalion or whatever they have in the Army, depends on how many people we're killing. You know, I mean, I think if I've read Karl Malarkey's books correctly, that seemed to be an issue in Matterhorn, you know, how many people could they kill? And so, you know, I mean, I think this stuff's really complicated, Mac. We're talking about humans not being able to determine what's right and wrong sometimes, and maybe some of them don't care. You know, that's a number of my thoughts. I didn't see a whole lot of that kind of stuff, personally, other than that first incident. I can think of one time during the siege of Quezon, we got caught in a nasty firefight, and I was advancing to the front of the battlefield with a platoon sergeant because I was his radio man, and I looked off the direction, and I saw a group of Marines that had a prisoner, a North Vietnamese prisoner, kneeling on the ground. And as I was watching them, a barrage of mortars fell on that position and blew the hell out of them, and right then, somebody whipped out a .45 and shot this guy in the head. So, you know, it didn't bother me at the time. I just figured it was just, this is what we do, man. This is what we do. Matter of fact, I forgot about it for years. And, you know, the brutality of war colors all of this stuff in the minds, I believe, of the participants. I remember right before the siege, going on a work party, and we were putting up concertina wire someplace around the perimeter of the combat base. It was myself and some men in my fire team. We heard a helicopter coming around, and we looked down, and there was a guy hanging off of a cable, and they were dragging him through the tops of the trees. We assumed to make him talk. I don't know who he was, but I mean, it was the, that hadn't heard. So, you know what I mean? So this was going on all over the place, I guess.
Talk to me about, I'm going to throw out subjects, and I'm just curious, you know, give me your thoughts on them and relative to your experience. Did you guys have race issues? I remember one of the things that it made me smile when you said it. You said that you listened to all kinds of music in Vietnam because normally there was only one record player. And there was guys who like country music, there was guys who like rock and roll, there was guys who like R&B. And so, you know, in the spirit of democracy, you took turns listening to each other's music. It was the first time we go to war as a nation integrated black and white. We'd been integrated relative to Hispanics, but not black and white. Was race an issue at Quezon? Or was race an issue for you guys?
Well, it wasn't for me. You know, I mean, some of the best Marines I ever knew were not white. So, I mean, and to me, it was always like a bullet won't go around a white guy to kill a black guy. I mean, so I didn't have an issue with it, and I didn't see much of it, although I'm sure it was there. I mean, if you were a black guy or a white guy that came from Georgia, I mean, or South Carolina, and a lot of our guys were from that part of the country. You know, they had not gotten all their issues about, and they still haven't. But I mean, back then it was like you still had segregation and segregated schools, and so I didn't see it. And I'm not, you know, I'm not saying it wasn't there, but it wasn't latent. I mean, it wasn't active. Excuse me. So I didn't see it, but, you know, I think it was there in other units, and it could have been just because at Quezon it was such a pain in the butt to survive that you didn't have time to be worried about those things.
So you had other more important things occupying your life than that. But it was a background issue because, I mean, depending on, as you just said, I think very well, Ken, depending on where you were in the, in the United States, the way you were raised, you had either dealt with this or you had not dealt with this. And if it wasn't dealt with, then you came from, Jim Crow part of the country, then it was probably an issue, right? I mean,
yes.
And that was just the way it was. I mean, cause the issue wasn't settled in the nation yet. So how could it be? It certainly could have been settled in units.
I'll never forget, not long before I left Vietnam, I mean, there was an African-American Marine, there was a hell of a Marine by the name of James Charles Richardson, who was from, I think, Albany, Georgia, and he was a prankster of the First Order, and he came and got me one night, and evening, and he says, a bunch of new guys got here, and they're down in his bunker, and he says, let's go down and mess with them. And so we went down there, and we stepped in his bunker, and there was a bunch of white guys sitting on one side and these black guys sitting on the other, so he jumps in there and asked these black guys why they were talking to these honkies, and he got them all riled up, and so it was my duty to do the same thing with the white guys, and then we had these guys all riled up, and then we started laughing. And you know, so, I mean, the issue was obviously there, but, it, you know, as far as I know, nobody in our unit was outwardly that way.
All right, fair enough. Talk to me about the cutting off of ears, scalping. Was that a part of what was considered normal for
no,
you guys?
No. And I don't, the only incident I ever saw that even came close to that was right after we got the case on, and this would have been in May of 67. We were out on Hill 881 North, and we found some carcasses out there that were partially buried in the mud.
Right.
And this guy pulled a femur out that had a tatters of a North Vietnamese uniform, and he got a rope and he hung that off the side of his dungarees and was walking around with it, and it, that lasted about an hour. And he was ordered to take that off, and we weren't going to do that. So I never saw any of that.
Interesting. How about one of the things that's really amazing reading about it, and so what I did was I watched as many interviews with veterans of Quezon as I could, and I don't mean the officers, because they didn't talk very much, but with the specialists, with the PFCs, with the sergeants, and the subject of rape comes up. Was rape something that was okay?
Well, I don't think it was officially okay. We didn't deal with that kind of stuff, Mac. I mean, our experience with the indigenous people there was slim. We did not deal with Vietnamese people at all. After we got the case on, the only people we ever dealt with were what we call Montagnards, which were different. And they, our intersection with them was very limited. Occasionally we'd go out and take a corpsman out to the village, and they'd work on boils and, all that crap.
Right.
But we weren't in a combat situation with any of these people. Mostly if we had interaction with anybody different than us, it was an NVA, and that was men. So I never saw it, and I don't think it was permissible, but that doesn't mean that it didn't happen, because we're people, we're complicated critters. And in the throes of combat, the emotional turmoil is insane. I mean, it's wild. And people do stuff that they wouldn't normally, I don't think, do in a different situation. So.
Did you hear discussion of it? Because, we hear these things associated with Vietnam. And one of the things I've learned is that, Vietnam is a lot of different things depending on what year you were there and what part of the country you were in. The part of the country you were in, you were fighting the NVA, yes?
Right. I don't recall ever hearing much about it at all.
Did you have much contact with? Did you have much contact with the NVA? I mean, with the Viet Cong?
No, not up there. We did have a little bit before I'd gone up there, but. Right. Not much. I mean, where I was at was in a no-fire zone, and they cleaned everybody out. They had marched them off to, I call them concentration camps. They'd taken all the people that had lived there and moved them out. So there wasn't anybody living there.
Right.
They'd all been moved out. So in terms of interplay with the Vietnamese population itself, I had almost none.
Got it. I got to take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk about stereotypes relative to Vietnam and your thoughts on that, because you guys have paid, as a Vietnam veteran, whether you like it or not, you're colored a certain way, and I want to talk to you about that, because pretty amazing the way you guys were colored and your experience. You know, obviously nothing like, you know, what you've been colored to be. So if you don't mind, I'm going to take a quick break. We come back. My guest today, Ken Rogers, former Lance Corporal, United States Marine Corps, infantryman, 0311.
Right.
Backbone of the Marine Corps. More of a Marine Radio from Boise, Idaho, coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Okay.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, BattleMug.com.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website. Look at what events they have lined up. Attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is,
Visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue on a Wednesday, Hump Day. Continuing with me is Ken Rogers. Lance Corporal's Height, United States Marine Corps, 0311. Veteran of Quezon, a documentary filmmaker, award-winning documentary filmmaker. The film is entitled Bravo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. Ken and I first met when I saw that that his documentary had been recognized by the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation, Ken? Who actually gave you the award?
Well, the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation gave us an award, the 2016 Norman Hatch Best Feature-Length Documentary Film.
Wow. Well, that's how Ken gets on my radar. Then I had him on, and the story that he tells along with the documentary itself are incredible of what the Marines who fought at Quezon went through. It is a story of Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 26 Marines. It's entitled Bravo! Exclamation mark, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. If you have not seen it, you should, by all means. It is riveting in terms of what Ken and the men of his company and battalion went through. So, let me ask you about drugs. Were drugs a part of your life at Quezon?
Not mine, but they were around. Not like I think that they came to be in Vietnam, but my two experiences with it were in September of, or early October of 1967, middle of the monsoon, lots of guys on no duty because their feet were rotten off from trench rot, from all the wet. So those of us that didn't have that malady were doing work parties all day, patrols all day, ambushes at night, LPs at night. So we went on an LP with three other Marines from our platoon, and one of them had just come back off an R&R, and he had some pot. And so he said, we're going to smoke this pot. And I said, well, I'm not going to smoke that pot. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, we'll smoke the pot. And he said, this pot's so good, we're going to stay awake all night. You don't have to worry about anything. So I went to sleep because I was sleep deprived. And they got so loaded, I guess, they couldn't respond to the radio. You know, you're supposed to check in every 15 minutes or half an hour.
Right,
I don't remember
right,
what
right. One of the two.
Standard operating procedures. But when we went in the next morning, I caught an unmerciful amount of shit because we'd gone to sleep out there. That was my first experience with it. And the second experience with it was it was Christmas Eve. We were out on Hill 881, and this was 67 too. And one of our sergeants had gotten a hold of some, and he was a hell of a guy. He was a hell of a good Marine, but he got stoned, and he got so loaded he thought he saw something in the trench, and he bent over and he fell down in his head and dislocated his shoulder. So, you know, I was observing all this stuff, and I came to the conclusion that I didn't want to die, and I figured if you were smoking that stuff like that was that powerful, that was a good way to die.
You know what? I've heard of different versions of that from guys whose bottom line was this. Hey, there might have been some places in Vietnam where guys could have done drugs on a regular basis, but when you played You Bet Your Life every day, there were guys around you that would have put an end to that in a hurry, and they would have let you know.
So.
They let you know that there was going to be a problem if you continued down that road. And so I find that very interesting, that it was more prevalent at the fixed bases, extremely prevalent among individuals that supported the war, not the individuals more so than those who fought the war. But the other thing they said, but if you had bad leaders, I don't doubt that if they allowed it, that it would have been rampant in a unit. So it gets back to the leadership thing.
I think you're right.
Interesting. I've learned a lot from Vietnam veterans. They're smart. They're full of wisdom. We haven't used it to the extent that I think we probably should have, Ken. Talk to me about the stereotype. So you come home in 1969. When do you get discharged?
No, I came home. I came home from Vietnam in 68, and I got out of the Marine Corps in November of 69.
Okay. So. I think My Lai hits the news in 70. Do you recall the first time you heard about it? And then I want to talk about the stereotypical Vietnam veteran and the way My Lai colors the service of a lot of people. But do you remember the first time you heard about it and what you thought?
Well, I remember reading about it. I remember being very disappointed. Very, very, very disappointed about it. And it was just like, you know, and I think this is, you know, you're asking a good question because it's going to lead us right into what you want to talk about. But I think I probably came to the conclusion right then that we didn't need to be depicted any worse than we had already been depicted, and that was just going to really add to it. I was disappointed. I mean, it was just, and I was angry. I remember it made me angry.
So you were already angry coming home, right?
Oh yeah, you know, I mean, who isn't when you get out of combat? I mean, you're a pissed off dude, and then people have been trying to kill you. So,
just for the record, we're talking about caisson pissed, okay? We're not talking about other kinds of pissed. We're talking about caisson pissed, and that's a little different variety. And if you don't understand it, buy the DVD, Bravo. Uncommon Men, Uncommon Valor, just do a search, you'll find it, watch it, and watch the shit these guys live through. It's absolute, for 77 fucking days, it's absolutely amazing. So it happens, and then you're all stained by this. So the stain of the Vietnam veteran, how does that affect you, Ken?
Well, you know, my experience with being mistreated by anybody was not much. Mostly it was just, but people didn't want to talk about it. You know, I remember coming home. I remember flying into LA from Okinawa after Vietnam. And I'm 125 pounds, skinny, scared, frightened guy suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and moral injury and every other goddamn thing you can think of, and nobody even noticed me. I mean, they didn't even care. That was my take. So, that was the initial shock. And, you know, I had a lot of friends who were anti-war, but they never said much to me about it. It was like, because we were personal, but, you know, it was a personal thing between me. The worst I ever saw was from World War II veterans. I mean, I got more than once dressed down and scolded because we were a bunch of losers. And I think that was, that was a hard to take. But because the men in my unit were not losers. We were not losers. So, you know, it was like what you did in combat. You kept your head down there.
Hold on. I've never heard anybody say that before. That you got dressed down by World War II veterans for what?
For being losers.
So
I never, 1978, I had a friend that owned a sporting goods store in town I lived in, a good friend of mine, and I went in to see him, and there was a guy in there, and this guy, my friend and I were talking about Vietnam, and this guy, this older fella comes up to me and he says, "You a Vietnam veteran?" And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "You guys are disgusting." He says, "You couldn't whip anybody." And it was, you know, I wanted to rip this guy's face off, man. And I come to find out he was a World War II vet, because my friend knew him. I didn't know this guy. From Adam, I didn't know anything about him. But
right.
Yeah, I got, and I, in 1972, I went to a VFW with a bunch of Vietnam vets because one of our, it was a group at a college, and one of the guys was in the group said, "The VFW wants you to come." And we got there, and then we got several guys told us we were a bunch of losers. So I left. So,
wow.
And, you know, it was like after that kind of stuff, what you did was keep your head down just like somebody's shooting at you, you know? And I mean, like, it's like one of the guys in the movie, my friend John Scala, who's a foreman, said, you know, for 15 years, nobody knew that I was a vet, a Vietnam vet. He said, nobody knew that. And I was pretty much the same. I remember working with people and for years, and they had no idea that I'd been in the Marine Corps and that I'd gone to Vietnam and fought in Vietnam, and they didn't care.
You know, Carl Marlanis tells a story that he coached soccer and was friends with a guy for 9 years before his wife tells him, "Hey, you know, so-and-so, he was in Vietnam too." He said that's the level that we distanced ourselves from discussing that. That this guy's a good friend of mine, and we've never spoken about it. Either one of our service. I didn't know he was in Vietnam, and he didn't know I was in Vietnam. That's the extent that we buried it.
There was a guy from West Virginia who was the In Bravo Company with me for a long time, who was a radio guy. I was the last 4 weeks of my service in Khe Sanh, I was a radio operator with a platoon sergeant, and he was the platoon commander's radio guy. We slept in the same hooch. We knew each other. We shared chow. And I got out of Vietnam before he did. And when I was eventually ended up at 32nd Street Naval Station in San Diego.
Living a good life.
And I was down. It was a good life. That was good duty. So anyway, I went into the admin office one day, and there he was standing there. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I said, "Hey, Horn." He said, "Hey, Rogers," and we never spoke about the war after that or our mutual experience ever. And we were in a bunch of Marines who were Vietnam vets. I mean, nobody talked about it. It wasn't something, you know, and I mean, some of it was, I think the natural reluctance of warriors to not talk about that kind of stuff.
Right.
But then we have this stigma, this onus of being losers and of being all this stuff that maybe 0.1% were.
Yeah, but there's 0.1% in World War II that did the same thing. There's 0.1% in Iraq and Afghanistan that did the same thing. And so I don't know, you know, you guys have been stained a certain way, certainly. And I mean stained in the woodworking sense, in that, you know, you're, like these words are associated more with Vietnam more than any other conflict, you know, and, you know, terms like racism, drugs, rape, you know, civilian casualties are more associated with Vietnam. And so when you your reluctance not to talk about what's unique, I think what's interesting about what you just said is most veterans in each other's company, you know, it's not like you bring it up and talk about it all the time, but they sometimes it'll seep out. "Hey, did you see this?" Or, "Hey, did you hear about this?" Or, "Hey, you know what happened to me?" You know, sometimes that stuff will happen. So, but again, given your experience, it doesn't surprise me in the least that it didn't. I want to ask you about the Commandant has this thing now in that he's kind of a tagline that he's created, "Keep Your Honor Clean." It has to deal with the Marines United stuff, the online behavior stuff. I think it has to do with the harassment of women in the Marine Corps. It has to do with the behavior at Parris Island, I would say by extension he would lump the urination on corpses in Afghanistan, as well as the murder of a guy by Marines in 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, where they drug him out of his house. What are your thoughts on, and again, what you don't know when you're young is that you have to live with that stuff forever. But you're young and stupid. You're young, dumb, and full of cum, right? I mean, that's the line. And you don't know this shit. And so you're pissed, and you're caught up in these events. And if there isn't somebody who puts their arm, their hand on your shoulder and says, hey, don't do that. Okay? You don't want to do that. And you're pissed, right? And he's saving you from yourself. And it's I think it's very well depicted in the series The Pacific. And it comes from Eugene Sledge's book, where he's so pissed on Okinawa that he's going to do something he's never done, which is field strip a Japanese soldier, and which is he's going to start taking gold fillings out. And the guy from who's in his mortar section from Louisiana, who's awesome in the series Pacific, I can't remember his name. But it seems like he never opens his eyes all the way. He's got these lazy eyelids, and he's got that Louisiana drawl that is very unique.
Yeah, I know who you're talking. Yeah,
right. You know, that character. He's an awesome character, and he does it. He field strips Japanese. He sees Sledge start to do it, and he gives him that sledgehammer. You don't want to do that, boy. And, you know, Sledge snaps back at him. You do it. Shut up. You know, shut the fuck up. Nah, Sledge, you don't want to do that, man. There's a lot of germs. And he uses the bullshit reason that the medical officer gave him for not to do it. But Sledge knows that he's telling him something deeper. In the absence of that steadying hand, you live with what you do does echo through the rest of your life. But we don't know that. Your thoughts?
Oh, you don't know it. You don't think anybody's going to find out, I suspect. You know, you're in here in the heat of the moment with your mates, and you're doing all this stuff, and your passions are running high, and you're afraid, and you're angry, and blah, 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 all of that stuff, and your moral compass is not working well, and you don't think anybody's going to find out, I suspect. You know, and we can do this, and nobody's going to tell, and nobody's going to know, and so there's not going to be any repercussion for my behavior.
And there are.
Of course.
There are.
But you don't know that because you're 20 years old.
Right. But we should be smarter, man. And again, you can disregard the class, but we should be better in terms of warning people that what you do in life you'll live with it. So be careful. I have an email for you. Hey, Mac.
Okay.
I'm sitting here really enjoying an extremely candid conversation that we truly don't hear very often with Vietnam vets. So first of all, bravo to you, and then in parentheses, the pun is absolutely intended, for having Ken on, and bravo to Ken for his candor in terms of talking about what was real in his service in Vietnam. My question comes to me from my own military experience. I've struggled to deal with issues that I didn't think we dealt with very well. I'm curious, Ken's a lot farther in the journey than we are. Do you make peace with that over time? Or is there always a piece of you that is unsettled with some of the things that you did?
So
old timer, give us the benefit of the wisdom of your years. Do we make peace?
I think it's somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
I think you have to make peace, or at least reconcile your behavior to what the social norms are outside you, or you're not going to be able to function at all. And I think that's the problem with a lot of these guys, is that the guys that we see that have problems is they've never have been able to reconcile that, we did this, and, You know, I can't go back. I can't change it. There's nothing I can do about it, so I need to go on. But it's still there, and it still bugs you, I think. It does me. And I didn't kill any civilians that I know of. I didn't.
No, and it might be just you could have done this and you did this.
I could have been a better Marine on this situation than I was, and you bet, man. I got those. And you know, you have to, if you're going to move forward and function, if you want to move forward and function, I guess is even a better question. If you want to move forward and function, you have to be able to reconcile with yourself that what you did cannot be changed. The only thing that you are in charge of is what you do next. And, it's real simple now that I'm 70 years old, but by God, when I was like 25 or 30, it was not a simple thing.
Right.
It took a long time. It took, I was a drunk for years. I was crazy. I did crazy shit. I was always out there on the edge doing stuff because I needed the thrills, and I never could get it through my head that all of this stuff is like, you need to stop doing this because what happened to you and you can't change it. I guess that's how I'd answer that.
All right. No, that's fair enough. Hold on. Another email about the stereotype. Mac, I just want to thank Ken for coming on and talking about this. The stereotype thing pisses me off, and it's hard for me to believe another veteran who fought would say that shit to Ken. I was sitting here, and when he said it, that pissed me off, because I think anybody who's had even a small taste of being shot at in a combat environment knows the confusion that reigns in those situations. That some guys make mistakes, that some guys aren't perfect. Come on, we all know that to be true. I venture to say, if you pulled back the curtain behind the victory of World War II, you'd find just as much of this shit as you have found in other conflicts. How those guys lived with the firebombing of Dresden and Tokyo, I think is interesting. Tens of thousands of civilians died there, but we justified it because of the total war we were in with Germany. Yet there wasn't one American city that was burned like that. I think we have an interesting way of dissecting the past to make peace with it. I just want to tell Ken, God bless you, and to every Vietnam veteran that might listen to this, you guys did as best as you could do, and we respect that. And you're Americans. We love you for what you did. We apologize for what you had to endure on the way home and here at home for all these years. God bless you. I hope you know that the country feels different about you guys now, and shame on the people who shit on you back in the day. God bless Semper Fi. Do you find more and more people respond like that?
Yeah, I do. And, I think one of the things that maybe gets missed here that I always felt was really critical in the way we were treated is, we had this notion as a nation that prior to our involvement in Vietnam, we'd never lost a war.
Right.
And I think that had a lot to do with the reaction a number of Americans had to our participation in that event. Going back to what your commenters say, those guys that made that statement to me, I don't know anything. They could have been, pogues back in the goddamn rear banging typewriters. Hell, maybe they never saw combat, So it's possible that, for their veterans, they were victors, they came home and they were praised, and here we were, we couldn't whip our way out of a wet paper bag. That was what my dad would have said. He never said that to me, but he said other things like that. So it's, we really respect and welcome, I think, the recognition we're gaining now. And, you know, it's just like, let's get on down the road and let's don't treat anybody else like that.
If that, I mean, to me, that's the lesson of, I would say anyway, is, and again, you go through these stereotypes. And the more, you know, the more I talk about this, the more I believe that General Lynch is right. You know, these things plagued any unit in any war that didn't have strong leadership. And if you had weak guys, weak leaders, then guess what? You were going to be plagued by this kind of stuff.
I think you're right.
And whether it was you know, killing Japanese prisoners that you didn't have to kill, or whether you killed Germans that you didn't have to kill, whether you stole stuff from people, whether you burned their houses down because you were pissed, all of that happens to organizations that aren't well led. And your example, Ken, is exactly correct, right? You're out on a patrol. Somebody grabs a femur, right? Straps it to his gear, and you continue the patrol.
Right.
Right. But somebody looked and said, "Hey, get rid of that."
I'm sure it was Staff Sergeant Robert Ward, who was a hell of a platoon sergeant. So, but you know, it's like, I read William Manchester wrote a book called Goodbye Darkness, which was about Marines in the Pacific in World War II. And I think the level of savagery there was at such a level that people murdered people all the time. I think Marines murdered Japanese people when they didn't have to. So I think you're right. Without somebody telling you, hey, you don't do that. We don't do that. We're Marines. We don't do that. We're humans. We don't do that. It's going to happen because, I've always been of the philosophy that the first thing you learn in your life are emotional reactions, and those are the most powerful things that motivate how we behave. And later on, we can learn rational stuff, and we can learn, you know, what's right and what's wrong based on some moral compass. But when the shit hits the fan, the emotions roar to the front and take control of us. And if somebody isn't there to exercise some supervision and remind us that we don't do that kind of stuff, that's what happens.
Well said. Well said. No, I think you're absolutely right. And the more I do this and the more I listen to this, and again, to me, and I don't do a whole lot of book reading about this stuff. I listen to people talk and I interview them and I try to ask, you know, pertinent questions. It's interesting. This kind of ties in what you're saying, ties in with something I heard yesterday. And that was, I had never heard audio from survivors of Iwo Jima or any of the Pacific battles. I'd never seen them interviewed. And I stumbled along into some interviews over the weekend that I'd never heard. And I was like, holy shit. And the guilt that the Japanese soldiers dealt with is incredible. You know, they were not supposed to surrender. Their names would be erased from their family rolls should they surrender. That was the culture that they grew up in. So they went home after they were taken prisoner. And if you didn't hear the programs yesterday, the interviews, listen to them. The guys that were in the last cave, and they're not too far from the beach. I think most Marines, you know, have memorized the shape of Iwo Jima. On the far right of the landing beaches, if you hang a right, you go through things like the amphitheater, the meat grinder, turkey knob, and those guys didn't advance shit. They didn't advance, I don't know, a few hundred meters, you know, from there. Well, this cave is somewhere in there, and at the end they pumped it full of salt water and then dumped fuel and oil in on top of the water. which meant that stuff stayed on top, and then they lit it on fire. That's how they got the last Japanese out of those caves. And the level of barbarity, right? But it was an ingenious, low-tech solution that they run a hose in there, a big hose, and start pumping salt water, right? And then when we get enough water in there, we're going to dump fuel in there, and we're going to light on fire. I mean, it's ingenious in terms of its low-tech nature. When you hear it from the Japanese perspective, when the fire starts, they said, you have soldiers with their skin falling off their faces, like seaweed hanging. And they describe this stuff, and you're sitting there going, I've always wondered what that experience was like. But holy shit. And one of the things, and so these guys wrestled in silence for years because, if the United States didn't want to deal with you, imagine what Japan felt for their sons who came back from places like Iwo Jima. They wanted no part of that conversation. And so in silence, they've thought, what was the purpose of our sacrifice? Why did my friends die without being able to talk to anybody about it? And you think about it and it's like, holy shit, the burden that those poor bastards carry. And so one of the things you said, one of those guys said yesterday, and it was this, we did the best that we could do. We were sent there as young men by a militarist government. I don't want to say that they died in vain, because I would never say that. It's too cruel. The only thing I can say is that we did our best. And I don't want the world to forget what they went through and how they died and their bravery and their courage and death. So it's interesting, the parallels between what soldiers and Marines have to say over the course of time. Let me ask you for a final thought. Stereotype of Vietnam, My Lai woven into it. Got any final thoughts before I let you go today?
Oh, no, other than I'm sure somebody will be having the same discussion 100 years from now, but I just think this is one of the things that it's part of the human condition, and it's not right, and it doesn't make it right, but it is. When we put people in stressful situations like this, where lives are on the line, you cannot expect young men to always make the right decisions. So, that's what I think.
Got it. All right, sir. First of all, thank you very much. You want to give us an update on the next project? First of all, tell everybody about the next project, and then give us an update.
Okay, so right now we are making a film working title, I Married the War, where we are interviewing wives of combat veterans. We've interviewed two women whose husbands were in the Middle East, one woman whose husband was in Vietnam, one woman whose husband was in Korea, and two women whose husbands were in World War II, one of them being Arthur Jackson, who won the Medal of Honor for his actions on Peleliu in 1944. And we intend to interview anywhere from 5 to 10 more women nationally. Right now we're in the grant money mode, getting more money so we can pay somebody to get on a plane with us and go talk to these women. So that's where we're at with that.
All right, and tell them where they can find Bravo.
Okay, you can get Bravo at www.bravotheproject.com. So it's available there. There's a tab on the page, buy the DVD. Right now that's how we are offering it. We're considering doing a video on demand, but I got to get that arranged in the technology I don't like messing with. So.
All right. Well, first of all, appreciate your candor this morning. Thank you very much for doing this.
You bet. My pleasure, man. Thanks for what you do and allowing people to talk. Well, you allow people to talk about this in an environment that none of us, I think, feel threatened by. So.
Yeah, well, he among you who is without sin cast the first stone. I got my hands in my pockets, man. I'm not throwing anything. So
one
of the cool things, Ken, is in this job is you know, I'm old enough, you know, hell, I have two sons that are Marines now, and I've seen enough and I paid attention enough in my life that, you know, there's incredible wisdom in a lot of different people if you do create an environment that's not judgmental and seeks to footnote that which we see, that which consumes us, that which occupies our brains for long periods of time in our life. And so to me, it's a labor of love. I'm sure just like Making Bravo was, you know, once you start it, it's pretty consuming. And I love doing it. I absolutely positively love doing it. So, again, thank you for those words, and thanks for coming on today. I appreciate it, as always. All right, bud. Thank you.
Semper Fi.
There you have it. Semper Fidelis. The one and only Ken Rogers. We're going to take a look at some news headlines coming up next. Here, Don't Touch That Dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.